Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Omar Ocampo of the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines how Trump's irrational and contradictory international tariffs will deepen U.S. economic inequality. Fred Glass, a labor historian and documentary filmmaker, who talks about the Trump resistance movement and the proposal of a general strike as an effective tactic to challenge injustice and authoritarian rule. And Jerome Wright of the New York State Jails Justice Network, who discusses the wildcat strike by New York State correction officers, where a central issue was a law that limits the use of solitary confinement. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Eritrea, a small East African nation with a population of 3.5 million people on the border of the Red Sea, had some of the most brutal prison conditions on earth. Isaias Afwerki, who became Eritrea's ruler after leading the liberation struggle to gain independence from Ethiopia, has banned opposition parties, independent media, and civil society groups. Afwerki's repressive regime that came into power in 1993 never adopted a working constitution and imprisoned journalists, ministers, and opposition leaders. A 2014 UN report estimated that there are 14,000 detainees in the nation's military prisons. Detainees that have escaped describe beatings, torture, forced labor, and many deaths of inmates in overcrowded prisons. The Guardian reports Eritrea's main export is people. Roughly a third of Eritreans live outside the country, having fled poverty, repression, and the policy of indefinite military service, which the UN likens to slavery. In a closely watched Supreme Court case, Ohio youth worker Marlene Ames, a straight white woman, is challenging the view that majority groups such as whites and men are required to meet a higher standard to bring job discrimination lawsuits than in racial or sexual bias cases brought by a member of a minority group. Ames filed her job discrimination lawsuit in 2020 after being demoted to a secretarial position from her previous administrative post and a $40,000 cut in pay at an Ohio youth services agency. Her position was given to a younger gay man, 30 years her junior. Ames claims she was passed over for an assignment to another management role for a woman she saw as less qualified but who was a lesbian. Lower courts ruled against Ames, requiring members of majority groups to meet a burden of proof known as background circumstances that is not required of minorities but demonstrates that their employer is the unusual one discriminating against majority groups. Ames' case does not directly implicate diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI initiatives that President Trump has tried to outlaw, but employment lawyers said a ruling for Ames and the backlash against DEI could make some companies think twice about continuing their DEI programs. A ruling in the case is expected by this summer. In Sewickley Creek in the rural western Pennsylvania town of Yukon, a small pipe releases wastewater from a nearby toxic landfill. The creek is a popular spot for kayaking and fishing, and in recent months, community activists have posted warning signs nearby to alert residents of the dangers of the hazardous discharge. The site, known as Max Environmental Technologies Landfill, has been out of compliance with federal clean water and hazardous waste regulations for the past 3 years. Scientists from local universities assessed the landfill's outflow and found arsenic, lead, and cyanide in the radioactive sediment downstream. That's linked to oil and gas waste, which has spiked during the state's natural gas fracking boom. For decades, community residents have complained about the dangerous toxins in the landfill, that many blame for a rise in cancer cases, miscarriages, and neurological disease. Inside Climate News reports that as Pennsylvania's natural gas production soared during the fracking boom, so has the volume of toxic solid waste and wastewater. Both activists and scientists say the government has failed to safely regulate the massive amount of this dangerous waste being created every day. Fracking reached record highs during the Biden years, and the Trump administration's energy policies are aimed at exponentially increasing U.S. oil and gas production in the years ahead. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Some 80 days into Donald Trump's second presidency, there's growing resistance to a wide range of his policies, as demonstrated when more than a million Americans took to the streets during nationwide hands-off protests on April 5th. Polls indicate that a majority disapprove of many of the twice-impeached convicted felon's policies, including his billionaire pal Elon Musk's demolition of federal programs, mass layoffs, and funding cuts to education, health research, and the undermining of popular social safety net programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. But Trump's imposition of across-the-board tariffs on virtually every nation in the world announced on April 2nd is also extremely unpopular. The stock market reacted by registering $6 trillion in losses and its steepest single-day decline since the crash that followed the 2020 emergence of the COVID-19 pandemic. Most economists warn that Trump's tariff-imposed taxes will harm both the U.S. and global economies, potentially triggering a global recession. A Reuters Ipsos poll found that 73% of Americans expect Trump's tariffs to trigger higher prices on everything. Trump rolled out his tariff policy with an erratic set of contradictory goals that includes generating more government revenue, bringing back manufacturing to the U.S., and using tariffs as a method to extort concessions from countries with which the U.S. has trade deficits. Your reporter spoke with Omar Ocampo, a researcher at the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Here he warns that Trump's tariffs will deepen U.S. economic inequality, as discussed in his recent article, Liberation Day Tariffs Will Concentrate Wealth Even More.
The problem with Trump's tariffs is that it's a widespread across-the-board tariffs on basically every country in the world where there's a baseline tariff of 10%. Some are speculating that the Trump administration just merely looked at our trade balance with country X and then they just divided it by how much we import. I think this is a fundamentally unserious approach to international trade politics, and it's not a wise plan for reindustrialization. So this is one of the main reasons why across the board, both on the left and the right there, have come out against Trump's tariffs, because Trump's tariffs alone, indiscriminately deployed, is not a plan or an industrial policy. This is why people are against it.
Omar, the thrust of your message in that article, I said, Liberation Day Tariffs Will Concentrate Wealth Even More. The focus of that article is that Trump's tariffs will exacerbate economic inequality in the U.S., already at the most extreme level since the Gilded Age of wealth disparity from the 1870s to the early 1900s. We're going back quite a ways. So tell us the short answer as to how these tariffs will really make income, wealth inequality so much worse here in the U.S.
There's two things here. So the first thing is that one of the rationales behind the tariff regime by Trump, in addition to, you know, bringing back manufacturing and trying to rebalance the trade, is the first stage of trying to dismantle progressive taxation. Because according to the Trump administration, the tariffs are going to bring in so much revenue that we can finally pay off our national debt. We'll run big trade surpluses to the point that, you know, income tax is irrelevant and no longer makes sense. we can fund public goods and services with the revenue rates from tariffs. But in my opinion, the only goal that has any real chance of succeeding within the next 4 years is not revitalizing manufacturing or balancing the trade budget. It's going to be weakening the progressive taxation. And I would like to offer a very clear example of how this wealth transfer, income transfer works. And it's through the national debt. So what is the national debt? When the government spends more money than it raises, it has to borrow money. And who does the government borrow money from? It could be a variety of actors. And one of the actors that it borrows from is U.S. households. And because of the extreme inequality that we have in this country, it's no surprise that the top 1% of households owns the majority share of national debt compared to other households. So now, how does the government pay down the national debt or make its interest payments? It's through tax revenue. So since we have progressive taxation, the majority of the revenue that goes to services debt actually comes from individuals or households who earn high incomes. But if we implement tariffs and get rid of progressive taxation, then the burden of taxation is heavier on the working class. And then, therefore, they will start to make up a greater share of the total revenue collected, which is then used to pay off the national debt, which is held disproportionately by wealthy households. So it's a wealth transfer. So basically, the taxes that the working class will pay will be regressive. They'll make up a greater share of the revenue generated by the U.S., and it will be transferred to the top 1% who own a significant share of the debt. When the wealthy have more money, you know, what do they do with their money? Or when you lower their taxes or eliminate their taxes, what do they do with their money? They don't invest it in productive job creation or creating, you know, productive jobs. They just end up buying assets. And one of those assets is government debt. So therefore, the government's actually going to end up borrowing money from the people they should be taxing. So this is one of the ways that this equals a wealth transfer or income transfer, because we're going to be taking the tax revenue from the working class, who we're going to make up a disproportionate share of the tax revenue. We're going to give it to the owners of debt, which is the top 1% of households.
That was Omar Ocampo, a researcher at the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Find a link to his article titled "Liberation Day Tariffs Will Concentrate Wealth Even More" by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On Saturday, April 5th, an estimated 1 million plus people nationwide participated in the largest one-day protest yet against the Trump-Musk Republican Party agenda since the former reality TV star returned to the White House. Hands-off protests took place in over 1,400 cities and towns in all 50 U.S. states, in Canada, in some European cities as well. Those opposing Trump's policies focused on a long list of issues, from the dismantling of federal agencies, the mass layoff of government workers, deportation of immigrants without due process, major cuts to education, and vengeful executive orders targeting law firms, universities, media outlets, and anyone perceived as a critic of the regime. Trump's imposition of unprecedented tariffs on nations around the world, triggering a stock market crash, the intentional sabotage of the Social Security system, and the GOP plan to cut billions of dollars from Medicaid was on the minds of many protesters who marched and rallied on April 5th. As Trump attempts to assert ever greater executive authority, ignoring checks and balances by the courts and Congress, there's growing alarm that the nation is in the midst of a deepening constitutional crisis. Your reporter spoke with Fred Glass, a labor historian and documentary filmmaker, who talks about the history of general strikes as a tactic to challenge injustice and autocracy, and United Auto Workers Union President Sean Fain's idea for a general strike on May Day 2028.
We have three lines of defense right now against encroaching fascism. First is the courts. And while the results there have been mixed so far, I think that ultimately the courts, if Trump continues to ignore them, the courts will simply be a holding action. It'll be a delay in implementing his programs. And especially with the Supreme Court and its not quite MAGA majority, but definitely conservative majority. So then there's the 2026 elections. And you know, Trump has dropped hints that he doesn't think maybe elections are necessary anymore. And maybe he's going to run a third term if there is, which is illegal at this point in time. He can't do that. But maybe the elections are not going to happen either. So that leaves the streets. And the streets are not meant to be a third line of defense that we put into place once the other two have failed. We have to be working on the streets all along because they will be bolstering the other two to the extent that we can. And also we need to build the muscles of the streets because we need it to get bigger and better. I've always been skeptical when I've heard calls, even for very good causes, for a general strike, because I'm a labor historian. I know about the general strikes that we have had in the United States, and it's a mixed record. We've only had about 15 or so, depending on how you define them, citywide general strikes, and none since 1946. General strikes don't emerge out of a vacuum. They tend to come during or as the crest of a strike wave. And what happened out of the UAW strike was Sean Fain, its president, asking unions around the country to line up their contracts next time they negotiated them for expiration at the same time, May 1st, 2028. This has gotten a lot of buzz within the labor movement. On the face of it, a call for a general strike now would be dicey. But this is a different moment now. Fascism is a new circumstance at the national level of the United States. We've had proto-fascism, you know, at different times in different places. Here in the United States, you could look at the Reconstruction South with the rise of the KKK and Jim Crow, you know, fascism. But we haven't seen yet until now this kind of effort to install fascism on the national level for everybody. The other reason I think that we can take some heart that there's this motion going on toward this is that it's a very considered call that Fain made. He didn't say, let's have a general strike. People call general strikes all the time, and we don't have general strikes. What he said was, we need to organize a general strike, and he started to put in place the conditions for doing so.
Fred, I just wanted to ask you, things are moving pretty fast in these first 75 days of the Trump regime, with lots of violations of the Constitution. There are certainly warning signs that Trump intends to and has already done in certain instances, violated court orders. Prospects for a lot of these appeals to the U.S. Supreme Court may not go a very good way for the Constitution, given its extremist supermajority. So we're girding for a constitutional crisis that may occur long before May 1st, 2028. Is it possible this framework that Sean Fain, UAW president, put out there could be speeded up where it's needed most, which may be in the coming months?
I'm hoping that that is the case, but let's talk about what a general strike requires. You need four elements. You need to have a generalized anger in the working class, which is what we're seeing develop day by day. And so that's good news for general strike fans. The second thing that's required is a structure that can pull off a general strike. So that would be the labor movement. We have, you know, central labor bodies in every state and in most of the major cities. And this is a framework upon which we could hang the organizing of a general strike. But not everybody in the labor movement at this point in time is convinced of the need of that. The third requirement is that you have a leadership that's willing to stick its neck out and call a general strike. It would be very embarrassing for labor leaders to call a general strike and for it to fizzle. Plus, there are some consequences, according to U.S. labor law, you know, that would accrue to leaders and to unions who go out on unauthorized strikes. The labor movement didn't get the rights that are now crumbling by paying too close attention to the anti-labor laws that existed before. So I'm not as worried about that part. If everybody violates these laws, they're not going to have enough space in the jails for everybody. The fourth thing is there's a spark, which almost inevitably is a worker getting killed. Not every time, but more than half of the times we've had citywide general strikes. It's possible with the kind of violent rhetoric coming out of the White House and the MAGA forces, with his release of the January 6th insurrectionists, you know, sending a signal that violence on behalf of Trump and Trumpism is just fine. There's that. A spark could well occur that involves that kind of violence.
That was Fred Glass, a labor historian and writer-director of the documentary film We Mean to Make Things Over, A History of May Day. Find a link to his recent article titled Best Guess, How Do We Defeat the Fascists? By visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On March 10th, a three-week-long wildcat strike by thousands of correction officers at New York State prisons protesting their working conditions ended when their union, the New York State Correctional Officers and Police Benevolent Association, reached a deal with Governor Kathy Hochul. The agreement included overtime provisions and a 90-day suspension of a law that limits prisoner solitary confinement. During the strike, at least 10 inmates died. 2,000 correction officers were fired when they refused to return to work. A state law called the HALT Act was passed by New York State's legislature in 2021 and was scheduled to be fully implemented in 2022. The law protects vulnerable classes of people from spending time in solitary confinement. That includes those with mental illness, physical disability, pregnant women or nursing mothers, those under 21 and over 55. The correction officers' strike was portrayed as being caused by opposition to HALT Act implementation, but some prisoners' rights advocates disagree. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Jerome R. Wright, a formerly incarcerated person who was subjected to periods of solitary confinement. He's now co-director of the HALT Solitary Campaign and director of the New York State Jails Justice Network. Here he discusses the correction officers' strike and the HALT Act's goal of reducing prison violence, benefiting both prisoners and officers.
Those who do have to spend time in solitary, by the law and under the Mandela rules, they would only have to do no more than 15 days in solitary confinement. And if they're to be held any longer than that for the nature of their offense or to finish the adjudication of the offense, they would be placed in what we call an RRU, and that's a residential rehabilitation unit, where they would be with other people who have been segregated but not isolated from population to do congregate activities, whether it be recreation, education, treatment, therapy, services, religious services, and the like. It is the attempt to put a more humane approach into the disciplinary process that has so long suffered from perpetual punishment of 23 hours in a cell every day and 1 hour out, and all the other things that come with it, the lack of communication, the lack of services, the lack of programming. It ameliorates all of those concerns. It provides a better, more conducive environment for changing and for the reduction of violence.
Was it ever implemented where people who were in those categories and did need to have some kind of disciplinary action taken where they were in these residential units where they got some kind of activities, if not actual treatment?
It has never been fully implemented, neither to the letter nor the spirit of the law. But that aside, I would be remiss in not telling you that it has saved lives and it has caused a couple of good things. One, the closing of Southport Correctional Facility, which was an all solitary facility. The stopping of what they call was keep lock, which is daily abuses of solitary by staff where they could just lock you in for any reason at any time. And it has freed a lot of people. People who have been in solitary confined for 10, 20, some even 30 years have been released back into population or at least into some form of RRU, but they're still doing solitary confinement illegally, and they have never fully implemented the HALT law. The real misconception by mostly everybody is that they went on strike as a result of the HALT law. First of all, that strike was a subterfuge to cover up on the beating, death, and lynching of Robert Brooks in Marcy Correctional. That death that was filmed on camera, that was shown worldwide, that was bringing back a lot of heat on the Department of Corrections, forced them to use the subterfuge of HALT to go out on strike and divert attention away from the brutal, senseless murder of Mr. Brooks. They figured that they would get some sympathy and empathy and everything else by going on strike, because they had already heard that as a result of the Brooks murder, that the legislature, both the Senate and the Assembly, had come together to form a package of Brooks bills to address the problems in corrections. And in an effort to stem the tide from that type of prison reform laws, they went on strike. They went on strike even after they had just had negotiations and signed a new contract, of which halt wasn't a primary issue, if any issue at all. And during that strike, 10, and now I'm hearing 12 incarcerated individuals died because they walked off the job and left them to fend for themselves, for medication, for medical attention, for suicide.
Yeah, I know that being incarcerated is a terrible thing, especially in our country, but working in a prison is also very high stress. So the COs who, whether they went on strike or they didn't, there's data that show that they have higher suicide rates and lower life expectancy and things like that. Do you see a need for reform that would also improve the lives of the correction officers, which would then presumably help improve the lives of the incarcerated?
Listen, there are good correction officers, just like there are bad correction officers. The problem is they don't root out the bad people in corrections, and the bad people, for even though they may be small in number, are large in stature, because they determine the culture. And the culture that's in there now is a racist, brutal, violent culture that is perpetuated by staff as well as anything that an incarceration person could do. If they had fully implemented HALT, which any place else that it's been implemented, it shows that violence decreases exponentially, that the staff that were initially reticent about having the program there all are now vying to work on those units because the violence is down and people are comporting themselves the way we're supposed to comport ourselves as human beings.
That was Jerome R. Wright, co-director of the HALT Solitary Campaign and director of the New York State Jails Justice Network. Learn more about the HALT Act and solitary confinement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WUML in Lowell, Massachusetts, KTAL in Las Cruces, New Mexico, KCBP in Modesto, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.